This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Hi, I'm Greg Watson, and welcome to this week's show of Property Matters, where we talk all things property, or at least as much as we can fit in to this half-hour show. Lovely to have you here. For those of you who are listening on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, thank you for listening along. And for those of you listening on podcast, thanks for being here. So this is the weekly show where we talk property, and we'll fit a few things in today. We'll do a little bit about the market, but we'll also look on at a few other things, like some of the most expensive suburbs in the country, what to do there. We're going to talk about a case where tenants brought a case against a landlord and then lost terribly. And that's quite an interesting case as well. And the tenant ended up having to pay the landlord quite a lot of money. So let's have a look at some of those things. There's that plus plenty more going into the market today, into the report today, I should say. So the market, where are we? Well, this article on September the 4th by Esther Taunton says, falling interest rates and increased activity signal a brighter spring for the housing market. So we talked in last week's show about the rates coming down, the official cash rates from all accounts amongst banks, etc. There's going to be a number of changes, a number of cuts still coming to interest rates, which will see things pop up. More properties popping up, more buyers being able to buy and service the sort of loans that will get them into a property at long last. So we will see a pickup. There is normally a pickup in the number of listings in spring as people perceive that it's a better time of year to sell. That's not necessarily true, but that is the perception. So a lot of people bring their homes on the market when it's nicer weather and the flowers looking nice and that sort of thing. So that's coupled with the ability now for people to buy a little easier. But just historically speaking, there was this article by Susan Edmonds on Radio New Zealand who said the median house value falls $30,000 from February. Now that's a bit of an alarmist article, but this is what she says. She says, forget a soft patch. New Zealand's property market has been going through a second downturn, CoreLogic says, and the median property value has dropped $30,000 since the most recent price peak. The property research firm has released its data for August, which shows value slipped nationally by 0.5 in the month, and that is the sixth monthly fall in prices in a row. So they're talking about $30,000 drops, but we're talking nationally. And I would like to bring to you information more about the Manawatu. We don't have that to hand, unfortunately. But the property research firm, like I say, says 0.5 in a month. Prices are down 3.7% from their most recent peak in February of this year. So you can apply that to whichever market you're listening in as a general trend. This does seem contrary to what I was just saying about the market and more properties coming on the market. In a sense, with it becoming easier to buy, you will find that there is more competition and that will begin to drive prices up again. So that's just on the way to go there. So the market will start going up, no doubt about it in my mind, and it's just a matter of whether you buy now or whether you wait a little. It seems to be me to be probably the best time to buy a property, at least in this region, a month or two for a long time, and things, I believe, will start to go up from here. How far up? Well, it depends where you want to buy as to how expensive you might like to go. And this article by Brianna McIlraith and Stuff says the most expensive suburbs in the country and how much you need to buy there. So if you've ever dreamed of living in a $1 million suburb, you already could be. As CoreLogic data shows, there are 242 suburbs with the average property value of over $1 million. But some suburbs were towering over others when it came to average property value. So they've taken a look at the top five most expensive suburbs in the country and how much a household would need to earn to be able to buy a property there. Herne Bay in Auckland, that's on the southwestern shore of the Waitemata Harbour. Herne Bay is the most expensive suburb in the country. The average estimated value of property was just under $3.4 million as of September the 1st, which was up from 3.2 the same time last year, seeing a 5.6% annual increase. This article shows some pictures of some properties, and boy, are they amazing. So Infometrics Chief Economist Gareth Kiernan crunched the affordability numbers, and to do so he looked at what the mortgage repayments would be based on a 20% deposit, a one-year fixed mortgage rate of 6.44 and a 30-year term, and made allowances for annual rates and insurance costs by looking up information on homes, etc. So Kiernan estimated to buy a property in Herne Bay, a household would need an income of roughly $808,000. Boy, that's amazing. The implied debt income figures are based on all the calculations that sit between 3.2 and 3.6. It's well within the limitations of the Reserve Bank. So where are the other expensive suburbs? St Mary's Bay in Auckland, estimated average of 2.7 million. You'd need to be earning in a household 654,000 to afford that. Westmere in Auckland, about 2.5 million. Remuera is around 2.5 million as well, and again it's showing some beautiful properties. Arrowtown, the Queenstown Lake District, averaged just under 2.5 million as well. So to be buying at that, you'd need an income of close to $600,000 before tax. So those are your most expensive suburbs, a number in Auckland, and then we've got Arrowtown as well. I guess how the other half live for the majority of us, and boy, I have to keep buying those lotto tickets to see how I go. Although, why would you move from this area? There's a article here from from New Zealand Business on Radio New Zealand that talks about a Wellington real estate agent's $200,000 loss. So this is, again, going back, and it is at a time before the market's going to go up. But let's have a look at what it says. It says, a Wellington real estate salesperson who lost about $200,000 on a new build townhouse says a similar situation is being played out around the country. Mike Robbers of Lowe & Co. Realty told clients last week that he and partner Sokita had signed a contract for a three-bedroom Wellington investment property which was not yet built in 2020. At the time, ASB were offering a 1.9% interest rate for new builds and expected rent would cover repayments. The market was booming, our incomes were solid, and we expected by the time it was built, our townhouse would be worth considerably more than what we agreed to pay for it. But by the time the house was built and ready for settlement, almost everything had changed. Interest rates hadn't just doubled, they'd quadrupled. Rents had tanked by more than 30%, unprecedented. The townhouse was no longer a viable investment and completely unaffordable for us to consider keeping, but property prices had dropped so much the property was now worth less than the remaining balance required to settle. He said with their incomes also down, he was not able to get the bank finance to settle. So whilst this sounds like a diabolical financial position to be in, it is one that many, many people found themselves in, caught by an unprecedented change in circumstances on multiple fronts. This is his words. He ended up using a second-tier lender to settle on the townhouse and did some painting and styling and got it sold within 4 weeks for around a $200,000 loss. He said the end result was that they had a bigger mortgage. So that's really sad. It's sad for anybody that's in that situation. He says, this is such a common story at the moment. If you don't see it mentioned much or the actual impact discussed, if 5,000 New Zealanders did something similar to us, perhaps a conservative estimate, that's $1 billion of equity wiped out over the last 24 months. If the properties have now been sold again at a loss, none of this is recoverable. So his experience there, combination of market factors and what has happened in the Wellington region, I wouldn't say that's typical of all around the country, but it's certainly something that we have been seeing, is where people have bought a house and then with those changes that have come in place, particularly as they're refixing and so forth, it's becoming very difficult indeed to be able to know what to do with property, really. If you can't rent it out and selling it at a loss, it's a very tough decision there. So why don't we have a look for a moment just on the other side of things at the city with the lowest average house value, this by Brianna McElrath on Stuff. See if you can guess. It has cheese rolls and rolling R's. And it also has prices under $500,000. Yes, it's welcome to Invercargill. The latest QV price index showed New Zealand's southernmost city had the lowest average house price in the country at just a little under $481,000, which had reduced by 1.1%. The figure is 4.3% higher than the same time last year, and now just 0.7% more than the start of 2024. And this was after earlier increasing by 1% and 0.4% in the June and July quarters respectively. But why is the city with a population of more than $60,000 so cheap to buy a property in? QV Operations Manager James Wilson said, one of the key reasons why Invercargill is one of New Zealand's most affordable main urban centres is that, compared to other cities, it's always been comprised of more entry-level suburbs than higher-valued owner-occupied suburbs. In addition to this, unlike the other main urban centres, we have certain locations that have a bigger impact on land value, including sea views, for example, and other geographic impacts. A significant proportion of Invercargill's established suburbs are relatively similar when it comes to these sorts of land value attributes. So typical buyers in Invercargill were also owner-occupiers, first-time buyers and investors who are happy to invest for longer-term rental yield as opposed to short-term capital growth. And this also contributes to Invercargill's relative affordability when compared to other main urban centres. Local QV registered valuer Andrew Ronald said the average capital value peaked in March 2022 at $498,000. Market conditions remain flat across all price brackets. There is still steady demand from first home buyers, and investors are beginning to return to the market with the restoration of interest tax deductibility rules. So continued high interest rates appear to be limiting price growth, he said. So again, those prices will be going up, but we've gone from one extreme to the other, where you're spending millions in Auckland through to $500,000 in Invercargill. So if you fancy a move and having less of a mortgage, that could possibly be for you, I suppose. Okay, we're going to go across to some tenants and landlord matters now for a little while. This article I thought was quite interesting and hopefully maybe of some help to you, particularly if you're a tenant. It says key money and other fees that landlords can't charge tenants. This article is on Stuff, if you want to refer to it, Esther Taunton from September the 9th. In a tight rental market, tenants might be willing to pay a little more to secure a property. But recent disputes taken to Tenancy Tribunal have highlighted the illegal practice of requesting key money. Key money is just a term, it's an inverted commas. It says, in a decision released last month, the tenant centre landlord had asked you to pay $500 key money on top of the bond and rent in advance. The landlord told the tribunal the extra money was paid because the tenancy began 2 weeks early. However, the tenancy agreement confirmed the tenancy start date, which was before the payment was made. The tribunal found the landlord's actions amounted to a request for key money and ordered the tenant to be reimbursed. If you're wondering what it has to do with keys, well, nothing at all as it goes. Here's the lowdown on key money and other fees your landlord can't charge you. So key money refers to any money other than rent and bond a landlord asks the tenants to pay for the granting or making changes to a tenancy. So requesting key money is prohibited under the Residential Tenancies Act, and landlords who do try to charge it can be ordered to pay damages of up to $1,500. So, okay, but if it's illegal, landlords aren't very likely to list it as key money, are they? How else might it be disguised? In another dispute held earlier this year, a tenant said she was charged an administration fee of $170 at the start of the tenancy. Her landlord said the fee was for Trade Me advertising. A third tenant also said advertising was the reason given for a $200 charge at the start of their tenancy. It's unbelievable. Why on earth would the tenants pay for the advertising? Oh my goodness, that's so crazy. In both these disputes, the tribunal found the charges were key money and the tenants should be refunded. In other cases, landlords have requested payment for credit checks, deposits for equipment like lawnmowers, and fees for running the tenancy. Are there any exceptions to the no key money rule? You can pay an option fee. This is money given to landlord to hold the property while a potential tenant decides whether to rent it or not. The maximum amount for an option fee is 1 week's rent. If the tenant decides to rent the property, the landlord must refund the option fee or put it towards rent. So it's a way that a tenant can show seriousness. about going ahead and renting the property before it is rented, before the paperwork is done. So what about letting fees? So few renters will look back fondly on the days of letting fees, which, up until the end of 2018, letting agents and solicitors were able to charge tenants. But, along with requests for key money, letting fees are now prohibited under the Residential Tenancies Act. However, while they can't charge tenants, letting agents can still choose to charge landlords for their services. And lawyers' fees? Also not cool. If your landlord is running up charges relating to your tenancy with their solicitor, that's on them. So you don't need to pay that either. So there's a few things there. All you need to worry about going to property is rent and bond. Right, here's an article that has a very scary headline. So let's just rip into it. This is from Amy Williams of Radio New Zealand on the 10th of September. It says, State House tenants had no warning home was on a floodplain before big storm. You can see this is going to go very badly. A woman whose Auckland State House flooded and tilted dangerously on the night of last January's storm was not told it was on a floodplain and says she was assured it was a safe place to live. When Kelly Day and her four children moved into a new two-storied house in Māngere in 2019, she thought nothing of the nearby creek. When I first moved them to that house, Kāinga Ora turned around and told me that it was a $1 million house and that it was safe for your family and to keep it clean and, you know, make it your own house. But the house on Ventura Street was built on a floodplain near Te Ararata stream, that's better, which flooded almost 200 nearby homes the night of the January 2023 storm. That night, Day was home alone with her four children, two teenagers, a baby and a toddler. I could see by about 5 o'clock the water was coming up. It was actually literally by my house, by the front door, she said. I took all my kids upstairs, took heaps of munchies and everything upstairs just so that we didn't have to go back downstairs if the water was to come into the house. A few days later, Day realised they were in a dangerous... Oh, sorry, beg your pardon. A few hours later, Day realised they were in a dangerous predicament. At about 8 o'clock, I went downstairs to see how far the water was coming, and I could actually feel the house tilting. It was really scary. Actually, I didn't know what I was feeling. I thought, oh, this is not right. And as I was walking down the stairs, it was starting to tilt. As she turned to walk back upstairs to her children, Day could feel the house moving. By then, I said to all my kids, get up, get out, the house is tilting. With the help of the teenagers, she evacuated her family in waist-deep floodwaters from the tilting house. Some of you may remember pictures that were on the news at the time. It wasn't necessarily this family, but it was really deep indeed. But like others in the neighbourhood, her car was submerged and they fled on foot with a neighbour to higher ground. Day said she should have been told the house was on a floodplain because of the potential risk. She had no contents insurance. They should be paying for everything that we've lost in that house because they're the ones that turned around and said in the first place that we were safe in that house through natural disasters. That's what they said. So Kāinga Regional Director Counties Manukau Angela Pierce said the Ventura Street House was built to the council standards for a 100-year storm, not the 200-year storm that hit the region. The Auckland rainfall on 27 January 2023 is considered an extreme one, and it's a 1 in 200-year storm event and exceeded the council code of practice and required standard of a 1 in 100-year storm event. She said building inspections of the Ventura Street house after the flooding showed no faults. Post-event inspections confirmed that the foundations were built to code and producer statements were issued by applicable engineers at the time of construction. But let's pop all that aside for a second. And do you think that people should be told that their home is on a floodplain? I guess if nothing else, that would mean that their tenant would probably take some insurance to cover their things. So Pierce said that state housing tenants are not told if their rental is on a floodplain. When offering our customers a Kāinga Ora home, we generally do not specify if the home is on a floodplain. It's important to note that even if a home is on a floodplain, mitigations would generally have been put in place to reduce the risk. If customers want to know about any potential natural hazards at a property they are considering moving into, this information is available through the local council. Interesting. That leads on to compensation claims. Day said that before evacuating a house the night of flooding, she called Kāinga Ora, explained to them that my house has been damaged, it's starting to tilt. They said to me, oh, could you please hang on, we can help you out the accommodation until we find you another house. I said, okay, then thank you very much, and what am I meant to do tonight? And they said, oh, you just have to find somewhere else to stay the night because we can't help you tonight. And the story goes on. Very interesting indeed. It just shows, I know when buying a house, it's very good to do all the background reports and that sort of thing. With renting a property, I don't think people would normally do that. And for a government-owned property, should they know that it's on a floodplain? And they should. But should they need to tell the tenants? I believe so. Hindsight's an easy thing. But certainly, I think the only thing that probably would have changed here, if anything, would be that the tenant might have still moved in, but just got insurance for contents, et cetera, just in case. Now, who knows? They may or they may not. But that's the nature of hindsight. Now, this article here from stuff.co.nz from Brianna McAuliffe again, tenancy complaint unravels for renter with order to pay landlords thousands. A renter who applied to the tenancy tribunal for compensation from his landlord has ended up paying thousands instead. Alex Folks sought a refund of his bond, compensation by way of a refund of all rent paid, and exemplary damages for breach of his quiet enjoyment, a tribunal decision said. Folks said his tenancy was significantly affected by the repainting of the Dunedin property in March and the scaffolding that was put up for roof repairs. He said the work, which he claimed carried on for the time he occupied the flat, was disruptive. In particular, he said he was unhappy about access to his flat, lack of privacy from the tradespeople, and safety from debris, the September decision published by the tribunal said. He cited an inability to work from home, noise, dirt, tradespeople starting work early and sometimes on weekends, the TV aerial needing shifting, and a leak. Sounds pretty bad. Let's see where this goes. The landlord, Philippa Wood, claimed to the tribunal she had advised Folks the scaffolding was being erected, but he was adamant he did not know when he signed the tenancy agreement. Wood had cross-applied to the tribunal for termination of the tenancy and rent arrears, but by the time of the hearing, Folks had vacated the premises by agreement, so she could only claim rent arrears. Due to the unhappiness with the conditions, which he felt made the property unlivable, and after discussions with an advice service, Folks reduced his weekly rent payments from $65 from the end of March, or to $65 from the end of March. Please don't do that, folks, as tenants. Don't reduce your rent, but go to Tenancy Tribunal to work that out. Otherwise, you end up in this position where you are technically not paying your rent. So Wood disagreed Folks' quiet enjoyment of the premises had been significantly affected because there are only two painters and two roofers on site. She provided alternative access for the tenant and had the scaffolding height lifted outside the external door of the flat, she told the tribunal. Furthermore, she had offered the tenant compensation and an early release from his fixed-term tenancy in March, which he declined to accept initially, it said. So what's the decision here? The tribunal ruled, after hearing from both parties and reviewing documentation and photos provided, that it was more likely than not that the tenant was told about the work and that quiet enjoyment of the property was not interrupted to the extent Folks said. Put simply, it is not credible that the landlord, in the midst of arranging an insurance claim and significant work arising from that, would not tell a prospective tenant about the upcoming repairs, the ruling said. While clearly the tenant would have suffered some inconvenience while the scaffolding was installed and the work being undertaken, the photographs do not support that this was insurmountable or for the whole period the tenant suggests. Moreover, I am satisfied the steps taken by the landlord to mitigate the situation, such as alternative access, an offer of compensation, early released from fixed term, repair of the TV aerial and covering the bathroom window because of privacy concerns, were reasonable. So Folks also owed Wood rent payments. The tribunal ordered him to pay $4,720.44 in rent arrears and filing fees, and he failed to get his $1,860 bond back. That, of course, would have gone to offsetting that amount of rent that he owed. So that's something there where he's probably, if you're a tenant, the thing that he did wrong there was withholding rent. If you do feel that you're in a similar situation, continue to pay the rent, but apply to Tenancy Tribunal for compensation around those sorts of matters. In other words, the only way that the rent can be changed is by mutual agreement with the landlord. We had both signed something in writing. This is changed downwards, I'm meaning, while work is being done. It's in our line of work, it's called a temporary rent reduction. So you sign up a temporary rent reduction for while the work's being done, the rent will be at a certain amount. That is one way you can do it. The other way to do it is to, after the work is done, to look at and there was no change to the rent, then as a tenant to apply to Tenancy Tribunal and get a determination of what that impact was on you to see if you can get some of your rent back. So he didn't get good advice there, which led him to go to court, and now he has a ruling against him, which of course looks bad for his record. Remember, landlords, when selecting tenants in future, can look that up. So please make sure you do things the right way if you're a tenant. Don't stop paying rent, pay it, but just apply for Tenancy Tribunal to look after you. That's what the law is there for, and that's to help you make sure that you are compensated fairly if these sorts of things happen. So that's all we've got time for this week. You've been listening to Property Matters on NPR. I'm Greg Watson. Yeah, Manawatū People's Radio, fantastic station. Thanks to the team here. Te reo, irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū. You've been listening to the Property Matters show. If you're also looking for this, you can find it on the npr.nz website. And not only that, it's also where podcasts are available. Just Google Greg Watson Property Matters and subscribe if you'd like to for a weekly show delivered to you. Thanks very much and have a great week.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.